Well, we haven't even begun yet, and I've already heard about 16 words that I don't understand.
We're talking about religion nobody really understands.
It's a mystery.
I'm hearing a little bit of an echo.
From us?
Nope, it's gone now. Cool. Okay. Welcome, everybody, to the – what show is this, Steve?
300.
I always forget.
10, I'm going to guess.
I mean the name of the show.
Oh, non-sucketer or non-sucky something or other.
That's right. Yeah.
Non-sucketer? Well,
yeah. And we have another dynamic Digital Hammurabi. You are not do not have the monopoly on cute, highly educated couples. And to demonstrate that, we have we're like the match game for academics and scholars here. That's what we are. And then we turn around and have shows about the earth being flat. So it's a you get your wide range here. Speaking of which, by the way, welcome to the show, Jerry Griffith and Dr. Misha Griffith. It's great to have you both here. I can't wait to hear the presentation tonight. But I wanted to get something out of the way starting out. And before I do that, tomorrow Miles Powers will be here. We're going to be talking about pseudoscience and harmful snake oil salesman, how not to be duped, that sort of thing. Friday, Lord Rael's emissary and his grace or something like that, some highly religious sounding title, will be here on to represent Lord Rael. So that would be fun. And then on Saturday, it's another Flatterday night where we will have Brother Ernest and Reds will be here. And then on Sunday, the Golden Nuns, which you two are, I will say, it is neck and neck between Dr. Griffith and Digital Hammurabi. So who will win out for the non-sex show's Educator of the Year? They are neck and neck. I can't say which way it's leaning, but it's very close. Wow. So tune in Sunday for that. We had an interesting thing happen today. I got a link literally minutes before we came live, and I actually haven't had a chance to listen to it either. But this person sent me a link saying that Mark Sargent, who, if you don't know who Mark Sargent is, he's a founding father, if you will, of the flat earthdom. He's one of the go-to guys. He does uploads all day long, but he was sent an email yesterday. I didn't know this until just a second ago, but it was Steve that actually sent this email, because I was literally, I jumped on to the call and I was telling Steve and everybody in the Griffiths about us wanting to play this clip. And Steve said, well, I sent him an email last night. And apparently he's responding to your email, Steve. Now, we're all hearing it together. I haven't heard it. So, Dave, let's put up Mr. Sargent's, you have to forgive me too. My allergies are messing with me today, so I sound really stuffed up. But let's hear what Mark Sargent has to say.
Hey, Steve, please check your sent files and note what you just did there. Hey, Mark, I believe you said you would be willing to come on Non Sequitur Show to engage with Red's Rhetoric or someone similar. Would you still be interested to do that in December? That's from Steve McRae, co-host of the Non Sequitur Show. No, I have never said once that I would be on the Non Sequitur Show. I'm sorry, you guys played dirty pool. It's a rigged game. You're awful people. I mean, there's other people that are worse, I suppose. But the fact that you have Red's Rhetoric is, you know, championing your cause, it does not help you. In fact, I've said that on somebody called in, but could have been Steve, called into my show and said, you know, asked the same thing. No, I'm not going to be doing the Non Sequitur Show anytime soon. I actually hope that other people, I mean, yeah, if you got a wild hair up your butt, I suppose you could do, you know, if you really felt like debating and you had no other outlets and you really, it's like, I got to get a debate in. Sure, go on that show. Just be prepared that you in no way will be treated fairly. when you do this. And
no way.
And the people they have debating, it's a gang fight, and it never ends well. But no. And no.
Okay. All right.
Moving on. So, this one.
A couple of things. Mark Sargent, it never goes well because your side never brings an argument. It doesn't not go well for anything that Steve or I or anybody that has anything to do with this show does. We are more than fair. The issue is this. In a debate, when you have two sides that are going against each other, the losing side is always going to look to everything else they can to blame, other than the fact that they don't have an argument. So the easiest thing to do is to blame either the venue on not being fair, technical issues, you were interrupted. It's never, ever the person that's having the debate has just a shitty argument. And time again, week after week, every time we do these shows, that's all that you have. You even had Jaronism, who is one of the biggest Flat Earth channels on here, admit during a debate that he didn't have at a debate that he was supposed to bring his model. So you say that we are awful people because actually I don't know why, because we've always been respectful of the people that we've had come on. I think we've been fair. At least I know me especially, I always make sure that both sides get their arguments in. You're angry because when they come on here, they look stupid because they don't have an argument. That's it. It's not that we're awful people or anything that you said in that call was true. That's full of it. You're an awful person for spinning it that way. You're an awful person. I know you like to think that you're some Gandhi of Flat Earth, but you're not. You are just as crooked and just as much of a snake oil salesman and just as much of a fraud as the lot of them. You just don't like it when you look bad. And if you don't like looking bad, don't agree to come on and debate with the adults. If you don't have an argument, don't come play with the big boys. And it sounds like you might not actually be that stupid, because you're saying now that you don't want to come on here, which I think is probably the smartest move you've ever made. Steve, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, Mark Sargent would leave comments on our videos. And granted, I will go on a limb here for the principle of charity. Maybe I read too much in what he wrote. If so, I will take the hit for that. But it sure seemed as if he was interested in, bringing something to the table when I had left him messages on the videos that he had comment on, that for the videos that he watched on our channel. But for him to say that we don't give Flat Earthers a fair platform is just absurd, because we do this every Saturday. They come on for hours. They spew whatever they can. We've sat there and said, here's your time. Go ahead. Give us some evidence. Never produced any. And as Kyle pointed out, and I think the greatest thing to Flat Earth to just destroy them was when Jaronism says, I don't have a model. No Flat Earther has ever brought a model. Why? Because there is none that works, Mark Sargent. You know this because you are a con man. You know for a fact that you're full of shit, and I will call you out personally. And if you ever have the balls to come on the show, I will one-on-one you.
There you go, Mark. If you think that you've got a case, then we will give you all the time you need and mute ourselves during the rounds. I have no problem being fair, but don't paint us like we don't give people the time, because we do. It's just that
lots of it.
You got to bring an argument to a debate. That's the thing. It's like somebody said one time, we like to go, we want a show where we can freely exchange ideas, you know, that we want to make sure that we go in there and both sides are able to exchange ideas. Well, you have to have ideas first to be able to do that. So when you come to an exchange of ideas and you don't have ideas, you're going to look dumb, and you can blame it on whatever. Okay. So that's enough for the Flat Earth part. Let's get into some heresies.
And isn't it the same?
By the way, I love the graphic. Yeah, well, yeah, it is. But take a second now, just in case. I can't imagine there is, but in case anybody doesn't know who you two are, you both have been on here before, and people have loved both. You know, they adore Dr. Griffith and and you two, Jerry. So go ahead and introduce yourselves and let people know who you are and what you do and all that good stuff.
Well, okay, we are a bunch of an old married couple who have nothing better to do than to lecture you about historical things that don't really affect your life in any way, shape, or form, because that's what we like to do. And get off my lawn! I have been a documentary filmmaker for a number of years, but I didn't make a lot of money at it, so I do other things, a lot of other video projects. And we did a lot of historical films together. Originally, she had a theater degree, and then mm-hmm. we started doing historical films. We found out we liked them, and she decided, if I may speak for you, that she didn't like carrying equipment around and liked being the smart one. So well, she's the smart one. I'm the camera guy. And we tend to enjoy discussing things, and we've got a bunch of great ideas that we're never going to do. So we said, why not? You guys have a good, successful show. Why not?
Bomb it.
Your time.
Yes.
But I want to jump in something here really quick, which is by way of introduction. You said tomorrow you have a guy talking about the dangers of pseudoscience and snake oil. And in many ways, mm-hmm. I think that's what we're going to talk about tonight as well. But from a historical Perfect. Perspective and from a time before science as we know it really existed. Science is a concept, a historian can correct me, mm-hmm. kind of evolved over time. It didn't really exist in many ways before Francis Bacon. And the modern concept really was Karl Popper in the early 20th century. So they were dealing with weird ideas that people were throwing around that they felt were harmful. You know, that you're out here saying that God wants you to wander around naked and tickle other people's toes, and we think that's harmful to our society, and God will punish us. And so they were trying to squash the same kind of pseudoscience. They just didn't really have the advantage of science. So they could only attack in the terms of, this is what we think it says.
Yeah. Definitely the idea that even going back as far as 400 or 500 years BCE, before our current era, you had natural philosophers, people who dabbled in science, but didn't do it in a methodical way. Not until Archimedes shows up and is starting to do all sorts of interesting projects. But at the same time, you had Archimedes doing his physics projects. You had Eratosthenes, the librarian of the Library of Alexandria, doing his measurements about the circumference of the earth. But you also had a guy named Aristotle. And Aristotle, have you got him? And Aristotle was a philosopher who was the student of Plato, who was a student of Socrates. He never met Socrates. But Aristotle's father was a doctor himself, a physician. And so Aristotle was very much into the material world and what we could observe. But unlike other...
material world.
All right. And unlike your basic scientist who's going to test things, Aristotle merely used his logic to kind of logic his way to approaches. So in many ways, we're seeing in the period we're talking about, well, here's an image of the idea of what the cosmos was like. So we're seeing a time at which people are trying to logic their way to conclusions. And of course, because of Aristotle, because he was very early on translated into Latin, he became the preeminent philosopher. He was just talked about in the medieval text as the philosopher. They didn't necessarily use his name. So this concept of not experimenting, not using empirical data, Aristotle thought that women had fewer teeth than men just because they were not as they were not men's equals. He never bothered looking in somebody's mouth. And so this...
Why would you?
What?
No, if logic is perfect, why would you bother to check?
Well, but logic is only perfect if you've got a systematic world in which I'm sorry, I'm thumping the table. You have a systematic world in which you have an argument that is A or B and there's no middle.
But if logic is perfect, and your conclusion is perfect, there's no reason to check. How could you possibly be wrong?
Because if you put bad premises inside of your argument, you can argue soundly, and Steve's going to back me up on this, you can argue soundly with perfect logic, and yet your conclusion will be unverifiable.
Well, why didn't you go to Kyle on that one?
Pardon?
Why didn't you go to Kyle on that one?
Kyle.
Go to Kyle on that. Yeah, why didn't you go to Kyle? Why did you automatically go to Steve?
Because I go to Kyle for fashion news.
Oh, I see. I see where this is. I see what this means. Okay.
No. Kyle, you are one of the better artists I know. So, I couldn't draw
just
my
not that
out
good
of
in the logic and reason category. Got it.
Don't know how to dress.
Oh, stop. Anyway.
So in many ways, that's where we wanted to start, was with looking at some of the history of these heresies and how different methods of thought. And of course, in the Christian era, you get the development of, well, what would you say was the earliest Christian heresy?
You have a better idea on that than me.
I know, but I was setting you up. It's called a dramatic pause.
I realize that, but I was going to let you go because you have an outlandish idea and I wasn't going to touch it with a 10-foot pole.
My opinion is that the earliest Christian heresy was Christianity. Christianity itself is heretical. In some ways, it was a heretical form of Judaism. It was a group of beliefs that were out of fashion. One of the reasons that they were persecuted by the Roman Empire, these are all out of order, was because they challenged you can talk about this. How did the early Christians challenge the power structure of the Roman Empire?
Well, basically the very nature of their religious ceremonies. Remember, Jesus didn't leave an instruction manual. That's something that Muhammad figured out 600 years later. But the very ecclesia or community, as we would call it, had to figure out how to form itself. And so the very earliest forms of worship were known as the agape love feasts. Agape is one of the 7 or 8 Greek words for love. Greeks had quite a few different words for love, depending on the kind of love and who loved each other. Agape was considered a selfless love. And these very early Christian gatherings, these very, very early Christian groupings were held in secret in rich women's homes, essentially. They would invite in other Christians, usually by secret signs or having known each other. They would invite people over for a feast, not just women. They would invite women, men, people of different social ranks, which was considered very racy by the Romans, and slaves, all sitting around a single table as equals, enjoying a feast.
What can you tell us about this image, by the way?
This is one very ancient fresco of an agape love feast. In fact, you can see the Greek agape over on the I guess it's our right. Yeah. And you can
Latin letters, by the way.
Yeah, and you can see these people gathered around a table eating, and of course they're eating a meal in reverence and in remembrance of the Last Supper, where Jesus offered the bread and wine. But if you were a detractor of these people, and many, many Romans were, because of the fact that they were violating all sorts of social boundaries, women, men, and slaves all eating together as equals, that was quite disturbing for them. And so they started making rumors about these agape love feasts. In fact, they would start using the wrong words for love. They would stop using agape and use a word like eros, which means sexual love. And then they talk about the feasting. And of course, the nature of communion, the nature of Eucharist, is that you are eating bread and drinking wine in remembrance of Jesus and his body and his blood. So you can easily imagine if you've got detractors out there who want to make Christians look bad, they're going to talk about these feasts, these erotic feasts where they're practicing cannibalism. And so you can see where this upset of society.
Okay, I want to jump in here.
Sure.
Because to me, there is another way that this upsets the social order. And mm-hmm. this, we're going to come back to this repeatedly. And again, the early church, the earliest church was, of course, not persecuted until a certain period of time.
Right. Several certain periods of time.
Well, it came in, it got worse, got lesser, and so on.
Right.
There is a particular Bible verse which came up, and I'm going to share it with you right now, which is, the congregation of believers was one in heart and soul. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they all shared everything that they owned. That's from the book of Acts. And that verse has probably caused more deaths. You'd have to make a chart. because that basically is advocating communism.
Right. So right off the bat, you've got a society, a very small group of people, but they are upsetting the social order. I don't think there was any thought in the heads of any of the emperors or anything that these Christians are going to come take over. They were upsetting the social order. They were a movement from the bottom up that was asking for some very revolutionary movements inside the Roman society, and that gave them
reputation.
Yeah, that's
right. Everybody needs somebody to blame,
right,
for your social problems. Anyway,
yes.
So my contention is that Christianity was originally a heresy, and one thing that we've found in our research is that typically, what do you call a heresy that is successful?
Orthodoxy.
Yeah. When a movement becomes mainstream, it becomes orthodox, and then it moves on to try to suppress the other heresies. You know, it's like everybody wants the monopoly.
It's the old Overton window, that the society is being pulled one way or the other. The idea of what is taboo versus what is acceptable to everybody versus that funny little area in the middle of discussion, things you can fight over. And so these are very flexible. These are going to move over time.
How are we doing, guys? We've been talking for 20 minutes. You haven't said much.
You guys are fantastic, but you both should do a channel like now. The chemistry that you two have on camera is just fantastic.
Well,
it's not as good as the chemistry Steve and I have, of course.
Of course not.
Oh, not.
And you guys have the advantage.
I'm kidding. It's so much better. It's so much better.
All right.
Totally
anyway,
joking.
So. Let's go on to real heresies.
Real heresies.
Real heresies.
Okay. Well, Dr. Griffith, what is heresy?
Well,
Webster's define.
Oh, he's breaking out a dictionary. Argument from dictionary.
You know what I mean, the key levels have to come down.
A lot of dictionary definition. That paper's dead. Sorry, gang. You know, there's no coming back from that problem. But if you go back to word origin, heresy comes from the Greek word to choose. And I think this gets at the heart of the matter, in that the people who take on heresies, who hold heresies, who have been instructed not to have these heresies, are choosing to be heretical. But I'm getting way ahead of myself, aren't I?
I'm just waiting.
Okay. When we're talking about the formation of the church.
Wait a second. Kyle, are you pro-choice?
Sir.
Heretic! 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 Burn him! Anyway. So.
There are many nights where I would take the burning.
Absolutely.
There's many nights when you probably do, from what I've seen on this show.
That's true.
Okay.
That is true, too.
True.
So, So what early Christianity had to do, aside from getting over those humps, is actually figure out what Christianity was supposed to be. Paul, of course, Paul of Tarsus, is going to be instrumental in including the Gentiles in the mix. And so it was no longer a heretical Jewish sect. It was now its own group, but it was still unformed. They didn't actually agree on the canon, what was to be in the Bible, and this is an early version of it, until 397.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought there were much.
There were gatherings of books, but I mean, they're still picking and choosing and throwing stuff out. Anyway.
That's after Jerome.
Yes, that's after Jerome.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerome went to a lot of trouble translating a whole bunch of books that he didn't need to because they were going to get thrown out by later Christians. So,
by the way, guys,
Jerome.
If we get too into the weeds here, you're welcome to stop us and say, who the hell was Jerome? And I don't know if you know that or not.
Who is Jerome?
Saint Jerome. Jerome of Antioch was one of the church fathers who basically created what the Catholic Church calls the Vulgate. He created the Latin translation of the Greek text of the Bible, which became the basis of Catholic theology from about...
He took on the Hebrew, too.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
That was the second part of what he did. He incorporated the text from the Hebrew and created what was the Latin Vulgate, which became the basis of the Latin theology from about 325 until,
The Vulgates were happening between 382 and 405.
And it lasted until about 2018, I believe.
Yeah, it's still going. Yeah, yeah. Jerome was...
It's like we're watching...
Like
you know how great this is? It's like Steve and I are watching a PBS show right now. This is how good, like an NPR almost... podcast. That's how good this is.
This is like a recorded thing that I am watching. I don't. This is live, right? They really do this in real time.
I'm not sure anymore. That's anyway, how good it is.
It's real time.
Okay. But once they've got the book settled on, they have to settle on doctrine, on orthodox ideas.
Orthodox.
Orthodox.
Right. What does orthodox mean?
Orthodox comes from the Greek ortho, meaning straight. And dox meaning opinion. So to say something is orthodox means it is the straight opinion. And so wavering off of these opinions is
opinion
heretical.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, so wavering off of these angles is not cool to the rest of the church. You want to keep on this straight opinion. And note, they're not saying straight truth, straight opinion. In other words, this has to be created. It has to be opinion that is revealed to somebody, i.e. the church hierarchy. Okay.
One of the things that I have found in my own research is that the issues that the church was willing to go to the bat with the hardest are the things that are really not that clear in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the concept of infant baptism. Now, the Bible says people have to be baptized. It doesn't really say details. There were people at various times, including especially the Anabaptists in
right.
the 15th century, who basically said that doesn't count. And the Catholic Church said, well, it's the basis of our power structure. Of course it counts.
Yeah.
And the Anabaptists were among the most harshly... Again, that's late Middle Ages. We were trying to go semi-chronologically here, but
okay.
We still haven't defined heresy. No, you still haven't listened to my definition of heresy.
I'm listening.
Which is basically, this is the church's definition, which came from a document issued in the year 190 called On the Detection and Overthrow of the So-Called Gnostics. That early. Long before there was any canon, while Christianity was still illegal, a whole range of things. But basically, heresy is defined within the church structure as... error held after correction by a baptized Christian. By definition, under this definition anyway, a Christian is a person who is baptized. If you're not baptized, doesn't matter what you believe, doesn't matter what you do.
Baptism,
you can't be heretic.
Baptism is one of the sacraments.
And one of the things, though, that came out during the 15th century in Spain was that, you know, they were persecuting people in this period, and there was some persecution of Jews, but only if the Jews had claimed to be Christian. But they were, because it was not the, you know, but what did they call that exactly? It was this whole period in Torquemada.
I remember.
I wasn't expecting the Spanish Inquisition. Oops, I got out of the loop.
Stop it.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
I love you guys so
much. Our three main powers? Two main powers. Our fear and surprise. No, fear and surprise and the fanatical. Let's stick to our own material. Anyway.
They haven't hung up as long as
that was yet, awesome.
Okay.
All right. So
they had planned that for several weeks, by the way.
Yeah. Special hats, special everything. Yeah. Stupid clip plays too long. Anyway, I want to talk about a gentleman by the name of Oregon, which the name is spelled like origin, which is really confusing. I have a picture of him here somewhere. But where are you? These are alphabetical. It's bottom.
There he is. Yeah.
Oregon was one of the very first of the church fathers. He wrote a whole series of tracts and documents. This was in around the year 250. He defined the Trinity and created something called the ransom theory of Christianity, which basically is still, you'll hear it from evangelicals today, the idea that Jesus' death is paying a ransom to free you from sin. This was a huge group of things, but he had some other issues which caused some controversy. One of them was, he wrote hundreds of these tracts. He was pretty much the father of a lot of the philosophies, but he said that there's the Trinity, which there was still being argued, the concept of the Trinity. I assume you guys are up on that. But basically he said the parts aren't equal and God created the Son, whereas other people said, no, the God and the Son existed at the same time. He argued that you could be liable for sins committed before birth. And according to his critics, he took special steps to prevent himself from committing certain sins. This is a drawing from the 15th century of him. Kyle, you're wincing.
I'm wondering if he's about to jump into those flames.
No. Cutting his balls off.
Oh, I didn't see that one coming.
Back to the picture.
Yeah, he's just got it underneath there, ready to.
I see it now. Okay, I see it now. Oh wow! Hey, when you see that, you can't unsee it. See, I think whoever the artist was, whoever painted this, it was actually he did a humanity a good thing because he painted a fire with a guy teetering on a ledge. So your eyes instantly go to, hey, what's that guy doing back there? And you're not focused on the guy that's cutting his balls off. So thank you, whoever painted that. You did a really good thing.
It's kind of a nice work of art if you don't look at the disturbing part of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, except the whole castration thing. It's fantastic.
Burning alive. Yeah.
Taking Matthew 23 a little bit too much to heart.
Okay. So Oregon was, again, during the Roman era, he was tortured and he was killed by the Romans. And to the early church, that makes you a saint. You're a saint. You died for the faith. You're a martyr. You're a hero. But they're like, yeah, but he cut his balls off. He talked about these other ideas that aren't, you know, connected with our doctrines. What are we going to do?
Aren't quite what we wanted.
So
yeah.
The Emperor Justinian pronounced an anathema on him in 549, which was like several hundred years later.
Right. So that they didn't have to worry about him anymore.
Yeah, but yeah. It's quite an issue because he's still, Justinian, there. There's a picture of Justinian for you.
There you go.
It takes a second for them to see it. But anyway. Anyway, so that's pretty. Justinian. He was the emperor. Rome, and we forget this, was really Christian for longer than it was pagan in terms of the Roman Empire. So
sure, because at around 300 310, 311, the Roman Emperor Constantine is going to move, you got him? The Roman Emperor Constantine is going to be moving the capital of the Roman Empire to Byzantium, to Constantinople. And the, it's in Turkey. And so the Roman Emperor for the next 1,200 years.
If you include the Byzantine period, yes.
Yeah, is going to consider himself at home in Constantinople.
Istanbul.
But the Roman Emperor is the guy who's the emperor of the Byzantine Empire until 1453. That's what they will call themselves. They will use all of the symbolism that they had used in Rome, et cetera, et cetera. And it's in Constantinople that most of the important movement, early movement in the church is going to happen. Except for a handful of edicts and that sort of thing. But what's going to happen is the idea of bringing in these conferences, having conferences, bringing in brilliant people to sift things out, to create what is the doctrine of the church. And so there's going to be the Council of Nicaea, and on and on, the Lateran councils. They all get numbered, they all get jumbled up, and only a handful really did a lot of meaningful stuff. But they were super important to the church, and everything would change after those things. But it was always this idea of a group doing it and coming to a conclusion rather than having a single person do it. And that prevents you from being heretical. Having those ideas okayed by everybody else, going through a committee to do this kind of work. This is where the heretics get in trouble, is that they go off on their own and they come up with ideas. And they're, you know, the church says, well, they're wrong. They're not what we have agreed to. So these councils are super, super important.
But to be clear,
can we go back to that? What are they doing to a headless corpse under the robe?
What are we doing?
The picture, what are they doing? They're like hands underneath the robe. It looks like somebody's headless, or is that somebody in a robe? Like, what's the middle figure? And why are they putting their hands underneath the robe?
What
are they doing?
I don't remember which one you're talking about.
I think it was this one. It was just a
that one?
Church
service. Oh, yeah. That's just the elevation of the host. Yeah, go ahead and show it.
They're elevating something, all right.
Okay, just to be
clear. They're holding the guy's like train.
Oh, no,
Steve.
They're robing him.
Yeah, there's a guy.
Oh, is that what they're probably standing there? Oh.
A cracker.
So they're grabbing his ass then.
What you do is you pass the guy and then everybody has a good laugh.
Yeah, they're holding his like cape. He's all in there.
At the same time, he is elevating the host, and this is a very early Catholic doctrine. Was that?
Oh, it wasn't early at all. No. Transubstantiation happened very late.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, a lot of people died over that doctrine.
Yeah. Well, they're going to argue the infamous idea of how many angels dance on the head of a pin,
never happened.
But they're going to argue about, for the communion, whatever bread we use for the communion, do we actually make it unleavened bread like it was in Passover times with the Jews, or do we make it out of leavened bread? You know, and that's the kind of thing they're going to
really
argue about
one way or another, right?
Yeah.
By the way, this is an image. Go ahead. Tell them about this image.
Oh, this is one of the earliest of the councils. I believe this is the Council of Nicaea. And this is going to take place. Nicaea is in Italy?
Turkey.
Okay. Anyway, and you're seeing a whole host of brilliant men getting together and describing, figuring these things out.
These figures on the left are the church fathers,
right?
Includes Jerome and August.
Augustine, Julius Africanus, Theophilus, that sort of thing. All group of guys. But this is important to note. They're all men. I'm going to have to use the P word, patriarchy. the church.
I thought you were going to say philosophy.
Yeah, the church is going to be modeled very much after the Roman Empire. Whereas in Rome, you had the emperor, then you had the senators, and then you had the administrative people, and then below you had the commoners, the average Roman, and then way below you had the slaves, but we won't talk about them. In the early church, same thing. You had the Pope or the Metropolitan or the Emperor on top, and very closely aligned with the Pope and or Metropolitan. That split's going to come a little bit later. And then you have the bishops who were like the senators. They were a consulting group. And many of these great church fathers were bishops in their own right. Augustine was the bishop of Hippo. Irenaeus was the bishop of Lyon, that sort of thing. They all have these positions. And then you've got the priests below that structure. But it was all entirely male. That very early ecclesia of the early church, where the women would be sponsoring these meetings and holding these dinners, parties, that's all gone. It becomes structured, codified, corporate sort of an ideal.
Okay, I wanted to jump forward a little bit and talk about when it starts getting, because we're talking about ideas and theories, and I think our audience wants to hear about blood and gore.
Yeah. Me too.
So you've got, over these centuries, this development of ideas, and one of the things we're seeing at this time is just all sorts of weird ideas being floated. One of my favorites is adoptionism, which we were mentioning earlier, which is had followers, and people were saying, okay, Jesus is the Son of God, but if Jesus was on earth and Jesus was born of natural parents, maybe Jesus was the adopted Son of God.
Okay, so why do you think these questions would come up? Why are they having to fish around for all these ideas?
Well, there's two possible reasons. Okay. One is that the Bible itself is kind of vague. The other one is that the Roman Catholic Church was in many ways as much Roman as it was Catholic.
Right.
And so it incorporated that structure. It wasn't just about what you believe and where you go when you die. It was about these whole roles in your life, the symbol, the
sacraments,
the ceremonial parts, birth, death, marriage, circumcision. Is that a ceremonial one? Never mind.
No.
No,
okay.
It's funny.
Here's the question. Where did these crazy ideas come from?
The same places the good ideas came from. Good ideas came from.
Which are?
Okay, the concept of the Trinity, which is this fundamental Christian dogma that there are three parts of God, but they are the same, but they are different, and you can't understand it, so don't ask.
Okay.
This is not clearly in the Bible. There
right.
are verses that kind of can be interpreted this way, but this is one of the ones they fought the most passionately
right.
over, and people were burned a lot for that one.
Right, but my question is, geographically and the time-wise, what about the geography and the time and what went before encouraged some of these different ideas?
Best.
Yes.
Ask them. They haven't spoken at
three
all.
Three to five sentence or less. Okay. But
ask us anything.
But I mean,
we know it all. We are. Yeah, go ahead. Take your best shot.
Okay,
ask
us. Okay, but yeah, what about the Middle East is influencing these people?
Sand.
So, like Manichaeism?
Okay. We haven't gone into Manichae. Now, Manichaeism is a philosophy which was founded by a guy named Manny, who was Persian. I got a picture.
There he is.
So, who the heck was this guy?
Manny.
How I love you. How I love you. Oh. Bad humor.
I bet he had nice rugs, though.
Ooh, is that an ethnic stereotype?
Stop. Anyway, continue
yes.
on.
Oh, I have to explain.
Roll right over. Yeah, you're
right.
The one that
well,
read
Manny
about.
Grew out of a combination of Christianity and Zoroastrianism, which was the popular religion in Persia. Zoroastrianism was, of course, a pre-Christian. Now, Zoroastrians are still with us today.
Right.
There are still churches, groups around, what do they call them? Which basically, they sort of worship light.
No, they don't. They were one of the first monotheist.
They were monotheistic. They worship a god named Ahura
Mazda.
Yes.
And they believed that, they believed in a lot of ideas that are going to be incorporated into Christianity, in that the idea of truth and light and the dark and untruth and the devil, those ideas are going to be prevalent in that.
But Manny developed and introduced a concept which was going to be central to a lot of heresies for a long time, which is dualism, which is that basically there's a world of the spirit, there's a world of the flesh, there's a perfect world, there's a mundane world. We live in this awful world, and God is perfect. And this is, okay, whatever. But it got in. They got into trouble because if Jesus was God and it came down to this imperfect world, then you're, this doesn't work.
Well, for dualism, the idea is that there is one supreme unknowable entity that created everything, and that is the world of the spirit, and it has no form, no shape. And the other side, the material side, is what we're struggling through now, and eventually we get to that realm of the spirit. But when you've got a system that says everything good is spiritual, supernatural, and everything bad is physical, what does that say for your institutions, for your art, for your, you know, decisions on what you're going to do today? And, oh, by the way, your savior was supposed to be a physical man. When you take and say that all physicality is bad, then Jesus could not have been a good or a perfect individual.
And some of the dualists said, well, then Jesus was never really here.
Right.
What you said with this hologram traveling around everywhere he went.
Right.
And I mean, now I see dualism took a lot of forms over the years.
Right.
Things. Manny was sort of the founder. He had a culture. Again, he died in 276, so we don't know a lot about him. There's not a lot of good information. But he basically said that, you know, there's two groups. There's the elect and there's the auditors. The rules of the Bible only apply to the elect. The auditors are here to be our servants. And then they played him alive.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was basically saying that all these sacraments that you want are physical and therefore are bad by their very nature.
But the word Manichaean is still with us.
Yeah. Right. That the idea that everything.
Right. Of course.
When you say filleted alive, how does that work?
Flay.
Yeah.
There is. You really want it? He wants it.
He wants it. Give it to him.
Yeah. Bring it.
Okay. Have you ever been deer hunting?
Have you ever watched the movie Game of Thrones, or the show Game of
Me?
Thrones? Because I believe they make some real references to it. Flaying is evolved.
Yes.
Certain type of knife, and you peel off the skin while a person is still alive.
As I said,
I'm more familiar with the Game of Thrones reference than I am the deer hunting reference. I mean, you would never catch me out in the woods. No. Mm-mm.
Okay.
I'll shoot Bambi all day long as long as it's with a camera.
Yeah, yeah.
I will eat Bambi because I love venison, but I won't shoot Bambi. But I'll die. Venison's good stuff.
So just quick follow-up to that. Just more of a curiosity. How long would somebody live after their skin like this?
Well, let's look it up.
I imagine if you don't hit any veins or arteries.
Obviously they tried to make it last as long as possible.
So you start at the extremities first.
How can we do this to people? Like our own fellow humans.
This is actually a fascinating thing, is that you believe your beliefs are so important that you need to do these horrible things to somebody.
You need to kill someone, you need to torture someone, et cetera, et cetera.
And, you know, we see, I think we're getting better. I think our society is better. But, you know, you get Matthew Shepard's, you know, in our lifetimes, you know, that people still think I'm going to do something horrible and it's going to cause people to change their behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Shepard? No.
Matthew Shepard, the guy in Colorado.
Montana. Anyway, but this very idea of inflicting pain to get at truth, this was something of a central part in Roman law. There were certain times in Roman law that the testimony of a slave could only be accepted if the slave was in fact tortured. If the slave came out with the information of their own free will or whatever, it wasn't admissible in court.
Matthew Shepard, if I remember, he was the kid from the University of Wyoming that was taken and tortured.
Wyoming, yeah.
Okay, I remember this.
That being cruel and barbaric to somebody is going to make other people behave differently. By the way, Wikipedia says flaying could take anywhere from 4 hours to 2 days for a person to die, because they could survive. Oh, yeah. It's a gross one.
1 minute would be excruciating.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if your body goes into some sort of shock, and if you don't, I don't want to find out.
Right.
Yeah.
But
no.
Manichaeism is a term that's still with us today, meaning
just if you have a situation where there is one side versus another side, and there's nothing, the middle is excluded, and you've got good and bad. The Cold War was very much a Manichaean struggle in between. You were either on the side of the communists or on the side of the capitalist, and there was no in the middle.
Now, the Manichaeans, this is an image of Persian image, obviously, of Mani before the emperor being judged and so on. There's a little controversy about what actually happens to him and so on. What's curious about Manichaeism and the whole movement is that it didn't die out. It went to China. And there were Manichaeans in China as late as the 15th century. It was like this bizarre movement. They basically followed him. And I'm sure that, like every religious tradition, they changed things and tweaked things over time. But it's kind of curious. Okay, did you want to talk about Priscilla?
Must we?
Sure.
We can. But we're going to just start throwing out some of the weird heresies, the early ones that are going to pop up usually before the year 1000. Usually they're kind of personality cults, but they're going to be throwing in ideas of the Gnostics and of the Manichaeans, the dualist idea. Yes. And these and they're going to be just popping up all over the place.
So we have something of a laundry list, and I think you want to get into some ideas. But I'll go ahead and talk about Priscillian for just a second. Priscillian was the That's Priscillian. He was a bishop. He created a movement in Spain and gathered hundreds of followers. And he taught that lay people should not be married, that you must fast on Sundays, that you should go live in the mountains during Lent, and you should use the word doctor to refer to each other. He also, and this is where he probably got into trouble, said that you can have take-home sacraments. That basically, the priest elevates the host, it's transubstantiated into the body of Christ, you can take it home, put it in the refrigerator, keep it fresh.
Nice. Jesus to go.
Take out Jesus.
What's he doing to that kid in that picture?
I don't think I want to know.
Priscillian was beheaded. This is the bishop blessing it. This is the first officially church-sanctioned execution of a heretic. It was in 380, I believe.
Ooh, that's early.
And it was a huge controversy at the time because, you know, should the church be killing people? Should any movement be killing people in order to forward its thoughts? And
I mean,
this is going to start... What's it?
I'm going to go with no.
No. But
yeah, they didn't listen.
Yeah, call me crazy.
We have heresies with us today. They may not be religious, but if I was to stand up and say, you know, the Nazis weren't all bad, that's a heresy. I would be condemned for having an error, and I would possibly lose my job.
Sleeping on the couch.
Funny you should say that. Steve and I just left a show called The Geek Room, and where they play videos from around the web, and we kind of comment on them. And the last video that they showed was an African-American man starting out with this long diatribe about Jews, and then doubled down on it by saying that Hitler was not all that bad. Let that sink in.
Well, Hitler said let you that shouldn't sink in. Smoke. I agree with him on that one.
Yeah, he was a vegetarian too. Yeah.
And yeah. He could draw.
He wasn't a bad artist, but again, it's I can't look at the work without
can't do it. Yeah.
But yeah. You know, the point is the fact that it's valid that, you know, I don't really want to talk to anybody who thinks Hitler was a decent guy. At the same time, it is a position that we're not willing to really discuss. We as a society agree Hitler was bad, end of story.
And a lot of the problem with these heresies was not that people of a certain conscience are going to start following them. It's that they start becoming political. They start as early as around the 4th century CE, in that the Visigoths, the Goths, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals. These are the tribes of Northern Europe that come to invade the Italian peninsula, supposedly the overthrow of the Roman Empire. These people were converting to what the people in Constantinople considered to be heresy. They were following groups like the heresy of Arianism.
Which is?
I don't remember. There's too many.
There are so many. And I've heard people talk about this and they expect me to know. And that's why I was expecting her to fill in and go, yes, that's right. But I've been busted.
Yeah, we're both busted.
Okay. You got somebody going in the comment section right now saying,
busted! Anyway.
Go ahead.
Okay. The denial of the true divinity of Jesus Christ taking various specific forms, but all agreed that Jesus Christ was created by the Father, that he had a beginning in time, and that the title Son of God was only a courtesy one.
Who cares?
Anyway. All right. But this is just a heresy of word. Heresy by deed. But these are the enemies of the emperor in Constantinople, and they're adopting a heretical stance in terms of their religion, still Christian, but a heretical Christian. And so you get political ideas being invested in this, including something called the iconoclastic controversy.
Ooh, the iconoclasts.
The iconoclasts.
That's a word we all use every day.
This was...
Well, let's start with what's an icon.
Right. Okay. An icon is basically a piece of art, usually very important in the Orthodox Church, the Greek and Russian Orthodox Church. It is a presentation of a holy person in perfection. This is the difference, one of the big differences between Roman Catholicism and Greek Orthodoxy, is that the holy person is seen as if you're looking into a window in heaven. So these images are going to be covered with gold foil. They're going to be covered with jewels. There is a whole procedure in creating these things. They are considered wonderworking in some places. They are move around in procession. They're valued quite highly. But the iconoclastic controversy came in where some of the thoughtful people are saying, wait a minute, the Bible says we're not supposed to have graven images. Aren't these icons graven images? And so it's going to start a controversy that's going to last for, I think, at least 100 years, started by Leo III, and it's going to keep going on for several hundred years. And this is a problem. This is going to make a division between East and West. Here's a nice little drawing of them prying a mosaic, an icon, off of the wall of churches. They did a huge amount of damage to art, these iconoclasts.
You know, there was a guy named Oliver Cromwell who did the same thing a thousand years later.
Exactly. Exactly. This is going to be a problem that's going to be an argument between the Protestants and the Catholics several hundred years later. But the iconoclastic controversy was not not Christians against some other group like the Jews or the Muslims or anything. It was Christian against Christian. They just could not agree on if they should keep these pictures or not.
Okay, and I know that they came in and out of fashion, that there was some popes that said, oh, absolutely, they're wonderful. And there was a gentleman by the name of Euthymius.
Euthymius, yes.
I love the name. Euthymius. Euthymius was bishop of the metropolitan. Sardis metropolitan area, metropolitan. And when icons came, you know, went out of fashion, and everybody said they're sinful, get rid of them. Euthymius. How did his mother call him? Euthymius, come and eat your dinner.
Anyway,
we just go ahead. Have to shorten it to you.
No, it starts with an E.
Well, yeah, it was written in Greek, so it probably starts with
whatever.
It's all Greek to me. So Euthymius, basically, when icons went out of fashion, he said, "Oh, okay, that's fine." And then icons came back into fashion, and he said, "I loved icons. I'm an iconophile. I've always believed that icons were the way to see our divinity." And then who's the next guy? Theo. Anyway.
Yeah.
The next, this is the Byzantine emperor came in, and basically he said, "I don't like them." And so he was basically busted. This is the emperor ordering his whipping to death. Byzantine Empire ordered Euthymius beaten to death in 831. And basically what happened was the times they kept changing, and he didn't change enough.
Right. Wow. But this is one of the big splits between the Eastern Church in Constantinople and the Western Church in Rome, because the Bishop of Rome, who was Gregory III at the time, really liked icons, really liked the artwork, because they were being set up in churches and set up in monasteries and became sites of pilgrimage. And so people would come to see them, and then they'd need a place to stay, and then they leave money for the perpetuation of the church or the monastery that they were visiting.
All of the money.
Yeah. So can I ask you about, the Bishop of Rome is going to say, yeah, that? We want to keep these.
What was that?
With the popes going back and forth between these icons, what were they given as reasons for why they were, you know, either willing to accept them or taking them away, you know, because there has to be some kind of, like, if you have a pope, one pope that's saying, yeah, these are fine, and then the next pope saying, wow, we got to get rid of these. Like, are they justifying it with any type of canon or whatever?
Well, the one argument is the Bible says no graven images, and the Old Testament is very clear on that. And another group says this is a sign of divinity. This is part of your relationship with God. This is there. And as we were saying, there's money involved, you know, and honestly, you get the diehard Puritan says, let's clean it up. We're going to follow the rule of letter. Another group says,
but eventually the whole argument is going to come down. It's going to be finally settled with the idea of we aren't worshiping the image. These images are an aid to worship. They are bringing into people's consciousness what we want them to know about these holy people. So therefore, they get left, but not before they do a lot of damage.
Well, yeah, destroying.
It would seem to me.
Iconoclast.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, just iconoclast is a term we still use today for somebody who likes to overthrow the order of things and upset the apple cart. And Yep. You know, they did a lot of damage to beautiful art. And of course, you have some of this in the Muslim world. You have those statues in Afghanistan that were blown up, essentially for the same reason, the same biblical text.
Well, of course, Muhammad was far more strict about no graven images. And that basically meant no images of humans. So when you see Islamic art develop, you do not see the emphasis on the human body. What you see is emphasis on calligraphy. You see emphasis on floral work, geometrical patterns, that sort of thing. But you don't see them drawing humans very often.
Interesting. Calligraphy is still very central to Arabic culture. And I haven't really paid attention.
Yep.
Even now you can't like draw Muhammad, or you can't show him in a human form. That's still something that's continued.
This is still part and parcel. And so now you know Christians went through that as well.
And there are certain sects that still are, but they don't kill people. Yeah. You know?
It would seem to me that, like, if it were me looking, you know, living back then, the Pope is supposed to be, you know, infallible. Like, what, he is the right hand of God, God's seat on, you know, this earth. So my question looking at this going on would be, why is God changing his mind so much? Why is he so fickle? You know, because it's constantly waving back and forth. And it seems like if you're following that, you know, God can't make his mind up.
Well, but this isn't God making up his mind. This is the Pope. This is the committee.
And also, infallibility comes and goes over time. Yeah, it's not the modern definition of infallibility of the Pope comes from the 19th century. It was largely codified after. There were times when the Pope was the supreme authority on earth, and there were other times when kings basically said, "You're out of here." There are two kings in the Middle Ages who kidnapped popes.
There were at least two popes who were beaten to death by mobs.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was one pope that they dug up and tried, wasn't it? They dug him up and put him on trial.
I mean,
he found guilty, I think, wasn't he? Yeah.
Gregory, I think his name was.
Sorry?
I think it was Gregory. Wasn't it Pope Gregory? That's the name of the pope?
There have been like 16 Gregories.
Boniface was tried after death, but I don't believe he was dug up. And Boniface was in the 13th century, and that's actually a story. I hope we have time to get to it.
Yeah, let's move forward.
Just in general, that was a big argument, was should we try the Pope? Because if we're trying him for heresy, how can the Pope commit heresy if he's the voice of God? This argument was done, but a lot of arguments, there's two things that settle arguments. They are swords and money. It's the golden rule. Who has the gold makes the rules. You don't like this, we're going to kill you. Suddenly, keep thinking.
But never forget, the Pope throughout most of the Middle Ages had no army. He was always dependent upon kings or princes or whoever had a big enough army to protect him, to defend him. And so this is going to make the Pope in some ways very weak, but in other ways, he's got something called soft power.
There are two powers that he has principally.
Right, because he has the power of salvation over everybody.
And he can pronounce excommunication.
You are no longer in communication with the church.
And interdict. Your entire town is no longer in communication with the church. And, you know, they basically said, okay, everybody in this town, nobody gets buried properly. No Christian burials, no baptisms. And, you know, in the modern age, we go,
but to the medieval mind, that meant they were all going to hell.
Right.
They didn't have
that's crazy.
Collateral damage.
So that's soft power. And some popes used it very effectively and other ones abused it.
Under what circumstances would they condemn a whole town? Just real quick, under what circumstances would they, you know, do that to an entire city or town where they would condemn the entire group of them?
Harboring a
harboring a known heretic.
Harboring a heretic, you know, so the heretic goes there, continues to preach in the region. They want them out. Not sending the money. The Albigensians, I believe, were placed under. Actually, they weren't. They didn't follow. But Jan Hus, when Jan Hus was, the entire town was placed under interdict because they wouldn't surrender Jan Hus to the Pope. He was a local priest, bishop, heretical leader. But I wanted to move on and talk about, by the 11th century, you're starting to see the real development of the priestly class, the real development of wealth, power, ostentation.
The development of feudalism. By the 11th century, they've probably got agriculture under control. They've got the three crop rotation system going. The agricultural revolution is in full swing so that people are able to feed themselves. So now we're stepping up the Maslow ladder, as it were, and worrying about bigger and more important things in the 11th century. But this is also the time that you have the East-West Schism, which means that you finally have a break between Rome and
Constantinople.
There's now the Bishop of Rome is now the Pope, and the leadership in Constantinople is there, and they're the Greek Orthodox Church. But what is happening at this time is that you've got the growth of the Muslim populations. You've got the Muslim dynasties. The Umayyads are going all the way across North Africa and up into Spain, and the Abbasids have moved through Syria and down into, well, it used to be Babylon. They changed the name to Baghdad. And so people are able to compare these two groups, and especially compare them in terms of who charged fewer taxes. The Byzantine Empire was really, really bad at charging huge taxes, but not giving people anything for it. But the other people were choosing the Muslim population. And so you're seeing, rather than Christians are trying to hash everything out, they're now saying, this is the way it is. You cannot argue against it. And so we have the birth of Cathars?
Feudalism. I was going to start actually with...
Okay.
Have either of you guys familiar with the musical The Book of Mormon?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Here's what was to me an utter shocker. This is a statue.
Yeah, don't have it.
Of the prophet Arnold. He was a real guy. This is Arnold of Brescia, and his followers were called Arnoldists. And Arnold lived in Rome early 12th century. And he basically said, you know, priests are supposed to be poor. You know, the church is supposed to take care of the soul. The secular state is supposed to take care of people. We're Rome. We want to recreate the Senate and the people of Rome. We want to create this whole movement. And the Arnoldists, and they were part of a movement called the Commune of Rome. And they created a semi-democratic state in Rome, and they basically said all of the priests have got to give up their worldly possessions, live lives of simple poverty. This was the start of a huge movement, and we're going to see three different incarnations of this belief in poverty, living this life of virtue, as opposed to these decadent palaces that the priests and the popes had gotten. They were summoned by the Pope, and he refused to go, and of course, you know, well, what are you going to do? You know, this is the end of Arnold. Yep. Anyway, Arnoldists stuck around. Yeah, he was took up smoking.
Nice.
You guys are cool. Okay, that's why we're here.
Yeah, you can't really call too soon on that one.
The Commune of Rome lasted for almost 60 years, I believe. I've got it in my notes here. And they continued after Arnold, and they curiously, a method of getting rid of it was they slowly reduced the number of senators until for the last 10 years, there was one senator who was essentially the king of the city. And eventually then the Pope said, fine, I'm taking over. They kind of went away, but it was part of this movement towards apostolic poverty that took hold in several areas around there. And it led to
Waldoism.
Yes.
The Waldensians.
Where's Waldo? This was the prophet Waldo who...
Yep. Nice.
Is that not...
Well, just like Jesus, he's hard to find,
wrong
too.
Wrong Waldo.
All right. How about this one? Peter Waldo. Curious fellow. Around 1200, 1205 was when he was in his heyday.
Yeah.
Peter Waldo formed a group called the Poor Men of Lyon. A lot of this stuff happens in southern France. I don't know what it is.
The water,
I guess.
Perrier.
Could be. The Poor Men of Lyon basically said, we wanted, and this is basically right after the Commune of Rome, we wanted poor priests. You won't give them to us, so we're going to do it ourselves. And they went off into the woods, and they formed these congregations. And I have some notes here. Let's see. They didn't believe in churches. They basically, everybody got together and met in people's homes. I guess they had love feasts. They were trying to go back to the early virtues.
Apostolic churches.
Apostolic poverty. And the Catholic Church really did play Where's Waldo? They sent out forces. They recruited people to go out into the woods of northern Italy and southern France and what is today Switzerland. And they couldn't find the guy. He seems to have died of natural causes. They never found him. There's some debate. The followers were called the Waldensians, and they were either named after Peter Waldo, who is the classic story. He was a rich guy who said, you know, this isn't right. I'm going to give up all my worldly goods and live this life of humble poverty. Although he had nice boots in this picture.
Yeah. Anyway.
But Wald is also, of course, the German word for forest, and they did live in the forest. So there's some debate about what that means. But so what happened to the Waldensians? Do you know?
No. Oh, yeah, they merged with one of the sects of the Methodist Church.
Presbyterians.
Yeah.
Waldensians now have large congregations in North Carolina.
Oh, that's where I am.
Yep.
They're mostly up in the Asheville area, but there are Waldensian churches to this day. And they basically, after the Protestant Reformation, they said, that's good. We're fine with that.
We'll go with that, yeah.
And
they were just
ahead of their
time.
What's their major difference?
400 years ahead of
their time. Like, what separates them from...
Other modern Protestants?
Actually, I believe they didn't accept the priesthood.
They don't accept priesthood. They didn't have churches in the normal sense, but they kind of merged with the Presbyterians today.
Right.
So they're pretty much, I believe, a mainstream Protestant group. Do you have any comments on your chat? I don't really know that much about them because they were meant to be a footnote. You weren't supposed to ask me that, Kyle.
But
I'm sorry.
The reason why we see some of these groups popping up, these heretics popping up who are insisting on poverty, is because what is happening in the Catholic Church at this moment? We have started to go through a period in which the popes are extraordinarily powerful in that, well, of course, starts with Urban II. Urban II gets a letter in 1095
from a good metropolitan.
Yeah. Urban II gets a letter from the Emperor Alexius Comnenus from Constantinople, who is writing Urban II saying, help, bring troops. I want to hire some of your knights that are running around. Bring them to Constantinople and help me fight off these new invaders called the Seljuk Turks. The Seljuk Turks had taken most of Syria, the Holy Land, and they were knocking on the door of Constantinople. And so Urban has this letter of invitation from Emperor Alexius Komnenos. That's not them. And Urban calls a council, the Council of Clermont at 1095, waves this letter around, waves his letter around, and says, our brother in Christ, Emperor Alexius Komnenos has asked for our help. The Arabs are overrunning the Holy Land. Urban doesn't actually show them the letter. He starts making stuff up. And Urban calls down what is will be known as the First Crusade. The idea of let's all go to the Holy Land and rescue Jerusalem and kick out the Muslims.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Nothing. And he, of course, leans over the lectern with his letter and uses probably two of the more dangerous words to be found in Europe then and now. Deus vult. God wills it. And this is going to electrify Europe. The start of the crusade, Deus vult, V-U-L-T.
That's just a curious coincidence.
And by that spring, the armies have started to gather, and they're heading off to the Holy Land. They have to go through Constantinople. Alexius had planned to just hire knights. But of course, the knights of the time, under the feudal system, you did not hire knights. Knights had a sacred duty to give the lord of the manor their lives. That's what they gave. And in return, the lord of the manor gives them some land, and they fight for the lord of the manor. And so if the lord of the manor was going to go fight in the crusade, these knights had to go too. Some people were excited. Some people were just stuck going. Some people were wanting to do a crusade. And of course, Pope Urban II sweetens the pot by telling everyone who goes, those people who go and fight in the crusade will be absolved of their sins.
This is where we get into problems.
And this is where we get into problems because, you see, you've got this whole class, social class of guys, knights. They were violent to begin with. That was their job, was to kill people. And so part of what Urban is doing is let's get these very violent people out of Europe. Let's send them far away. But once they get to Constantinople, it becomes absolutely clear these knights want to go on to the Holy Land. They are not interested in defending Constantinople. They want to take all the land that they can get between Constantinople and Jerusalem so that they can enlarge their manor. It doesn't occur to them with medieval transportation and medieval communication skills that if they have a nice plot of land up near Mainz, nice area, castle, etc., and they're making a good living, and a nice plot of land somewhere in Syria, they're not going to be able to control one or the other. But needless to say, land was wealth. That's what they wanted. So they're focused on this job, taking Jerusalem. Alexius realizes he can't keep feeding all of these guys. They're violent. They're eating a lot. And he finally says, fine, go to Jerusalem. And they fight their way down in this first crusade. They make it to Jerusalem and they take Jerusalem. The first crusade in that way is successful because they do make it to Jerusalem. They do take over the city. Once they break down the walls and get into the city, it becomes an absolute bloodbath. They will kill Muslims. They will kill Jews. They will kill Christians who happen to be hanging around. They're just going to go on this killing spree of the first crusade. According to eyewitnesses, the horses are wading through blood. The blood is coming up to the knees. It's pretty.
Okay. But the point is, you've got people who like to kill, and I'm absolved. I can do whatever I want.
And they're absolved of their sins. Meanwhile, on the way down, they've been busy killing Jews. They've been holding pogroms as well.
Now, notice we're still getting into the same issue here, which is that the Bible doesn't really say that the Pope has the power to right. authorize you to kill people.
Yeah, doesn't yeah. he doesn't have the power yeah. to authorize genocide. And he's authorizing genocide against the wrong persons. The letter asked for help fighting the Seljuk Turks. Urban just assumes they're all Arabs. And let's just kill all the Arabs.
Isn't it a big problem, too, that the Bible just leaves it open for both interpretations? You know, like, I'm sure the Pope that orders something like that can probably point to a verse where he thinks he is justified. And then people who are against that can point to where he's not justified in that. I think that's – isn't that like the entire problem with the Bible as a whole is that verses are open to interpretation. And that's why you get so many, like, split sects of religion, like, you know, Baptists, Methodists. There's so many different sure. factions.
But I think the idea of you are absolved from killing people in advance, killing and rape, I don't think that's mm-hmm. in there anywhere. And that's actually leading up to, in many ways, you should have done that part before I talked about the Commune of Paris.
Yes.
Because this is...
Okay, but
actually,
what...
Actually, it was
yeah.
before. That this, but yes, this is where
it
the,
is before.
This is where the church is getting so powerful, and they're needing this money,
yes.
and they're exploiting people to get money
right.
to go on crusades, mm-hmm. and...
Yes.
We have a real crisis, okay?
Yes. The church mm-hmm. is looking less like churchmen and an awful lot like those princes and kings that are back in Europe, building palaces, building castles, that sort of thing. They're not looking like holy men at all. And I think this is what many of the heretics are looking at and saying, hey, come on, we do have this model in the New Testament. And you popes and you bishops aren't looking anything like that model. But the popes and the bishops are going to have to say, look, we're in this society where we must deal with kings and barons and nobles and princes. And if we go in looking like impoverished guys in sandals and robes and you know, looking poor, they're not going to listen to us. We're no longer their equal.
God wants me to have a Learjet.
God wants me to have a Learjet.
I don't want to be
in
that
group of sinners. We don't, yeah. So definitely, yeah, this justification in order to keep within this status quo was important. And so we see several different heretical sects like the Waldensians grow up that are basically saying, look, we think we know a better way.
So for those of you watching at home, please rewind now after this portion and watch what we talked about with the Waldensians and then come back to this point afterwards, okay?
You don't have to.
All right.
All right.
It's all right.
We are not strict.
It's not a textbook.
Yeah, we're not strict around here. Not in these parts.
It's just two crazy people telling lots of useless information.
Lots of it. Okay.
That's pretty much our show from the beginning.
Yeah. That's day one. Okay. So we've kind of gotten into the formation of the modern concept of the knight.
Right.
I was going to leave the Templars to a little later, but you're sort of leading into it. But
no, the Templars, they don't get their thing until later. So we go on.
Push the tunic level. But we were going to move on next and talk about southern France.
Yay!
What happens in southern France? Well, you get the Cathars. And I'm going to do relatively briefly on this because it's just another heretical group and they're just out there. But the Pope authorized... The Cathars were a Manichean dualistic group that occupied a huge area. There were probably hundreds of thousands of them.
It was a very large group in southern France, around the cities of Nîmes, Aix, Arles.
Yes, and all the way over to the Spanish area.
To the Pyrenees. Yeah.
And I don't have it in front of me. They had a number of odd little rituals. This is poverty and chasing away the monks. I was supposed to cut that out.
But the Cathars were not just a group of people like the Waldensians out in the woods. They had societies of their own. They had castles. They had entire cities. They had a true social structure.
And this is actually part of the issue with the Cathars was, yes, the Pope launched a crusade on them, but it was not just grab a few heretics and burn them. This was like a true crusade, but it was in Southern Europe.
Well, the Pope is going to send emissaries, one after another, trying to go to these Cathars and instruct them that they are wrong. And one of the main emissaries is Saint Dominic. A little bit later. Anyway, so at one point, one of the papal emissaries is murdered by the Cathars. And this is just too much for the Pope.
It's the Middle Ages. It's what we do.
So the Urban II was able to call down a crusade on Jerusalem and the Holy Land. And this, is it Innocent the Third?
I believe it was Innocent the Second.
Innocent the Second or Innocent the Third calls down a crusade against the Cathars. So this is adopting the ideas of crusades. Same rules. You go and you fight and you're absolved of your sins, but you're not fighting Muslims in Jerusalem. You are fighting your next door neighbors in the south of France.
And this was historically quite significant because
yes,
the Pope had a great strategy for how to get people to fight for this. He went to the King of France. Remember who he was, but he went to the King of France and said, you know,
I don't have the King of France.
If you defeat these people, you get all their lands and you get to redistribute it to your friends.
No, he didn't, but that's...
What?
Not the King of France. That's another lecture.
This is part of French unification.
Yes, but he did. Okay, the King of France had a highly centralized government. He did not give away land. He broke it up into regions, and he made the nobles administrators of each of these regions. They did not have a hereditary ownership of the land.
Okay.
The king could move them around like chess pieces whenever he won. And the way he got them to agree to this is that he allowed them to live tax-free.
Okay, but this region was not part of France at the time.
Correct.
It is today. And it's basically, this is part of really big countries. France, you know, certainly by medieval standards, is huge.
Yes.
And yes, they kept losing parts of it to England and Italy. And back.
Anyway.
It was still huge. And this is part of the emergence of a modern nation, was this efforts against the Cathars. And, you know, as I said, they had really bloody wars. They fought for hundreds of years. There's an image of them finally being defeated out of the city of Carcassonne.
Carcassonne.
Yeah. Is probably one of the most beautiful cities in Europe today. Beautiful walled castle.
Still very medieval.
Still very, very lovely there. And of course, they did the usual things to the captured Cathars. You know, that's just...
Burn them at the stake.
But the Pope...
They're brutal back then.
...said they needed something stronger to go after these guys besides just guns. And they needed...
To re-educate them. That was the hope that they could turn these people, they could turn their heresy, because the idea was these people were ignorant. They did not understand the Orthodox system, the Orthodox thinking. And so what they needed to be done is to be educated. And so he's going to form a couple of different groups to do this.
Well, isn't there somebody who came to him with the...
Well, Dominic, going? Two of them come. Dominic comes to the Pope and asks to start an order. These are the Dominicans. These are the black friars. They actually wore white robes with black hoods on them. And Dominic is going to create this movement. They aren't the type of monks that are shut up in a monastery. They are in with the people, preaching to them. They are
an order of preachers.
And they were the order that influenced study as well. They opened universities. And when we get to the New World, several hundred years later, they're going to open up universities in the New World. So the Dominicans are very important in that way. The other man who comes to the Pope, Pope Innocent III, and asks to start an order is Saint Francis of Assisi. who was a young rich man who has a conversion experience, is overcome with a desire to solve poverty, and so he becomes a mendicant order, in that these are orders that are
begging,
basically. They go around begging, but they are there to solve the problem of poverty. But both the Franciscans and the Dominicans are busy in society trying to re-educate people to make them understand that their heresy is wrong. But it is the Dominicans who basically, once they're done with the Cathars, they're going to move out. They're going to move into Spain.
By the way, what did they call the office that St. Dominic started to go in there and deal with these people?
The Inquisition.
Oh, really?
You mean?
I've got to find that clip file. Give me that, a break.
It's okay. We already ruined the joke.
We ruined the joke, yes.
Okay.
It was the start of the Inquisition.
Yeah.
With St. Dominic. And but it's interesting to compare St. Francis with Peter Waldo. Now, Peter Waldo started from the outside, you know, tried to create the same, mm-hmm. some of the same ideas. St. Francis worked within the church.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, the modern Pope is a Franciscan, and they believed in poverty. They all took an oath of poverty.
Yeah.
Actually,
I think this is the thing that amuses me the most. Popes have had a tradition of naming themselves. They don't live the names, usually, of the names they take. They take a name when they become Pope. And oftentimes those names are aspirational. They send a message to the flock of what they want to do in their future. And so our current Pope is Francis. What number?
There is no number.
He's the first Francis.
I think he's the first Franciscan to be Pope, isn't
he? No, he's not the first Franciscan, but he's the first Francis. He is the first Pope who's out there saying, I want to solve poverty. So I think this is fascinating, gives you an insight into the man and into the structure itself.
That is cool.
Okay. It is cool, but the point is, you know, so it was working within the church and this acceptance of charity, helping, and so on. It
was just Waldo
wanted to break away from the church entirely.
But the mendicant orders and the Dominicans, they were open to not only friars, not only monks, but also the laity, people who wanted to be part of this movement, who wanted to express themselves in a spiritual way, joined up with this movement as well. So the laity who joined for only small periods of time were just as important as the monks themselves. But they were very different orders than had been before.
Speaking of orders and a flashback, one of the popes, and I cannot find his image because it's
okay.
No, I know. It's good. Work with me, babe.
Okay.
This particular pope, his name was Innocent II. I think I'm up to Innocent III now.
Yeah.
He wasn't so innocent, and he decided to form a group of an order, a religious order, but they were also an armed religious order. They were called the Knights Templar. And they're very trendy to talk about there. Yeah.
They had been on multiple crusades.
Yes, and the Knights Templar were not answerable to their lords. That was kind of the idea. So, and they successfully took over Jerusalem. You know,
in the first crusade, but not in the second or third or fourth.
They did pretty well, but they were exempt from all taxes. They were exempt from church tithes. So they basically anything they got, and of course, you know, you get. They got to keep. They developed their own banking system, which is really, in many ways, the origin of much of the modern banking system. I know. Anytime you talk about a point in history, there's always somebody says, well, you know, there's this guy 10 years before. But so the Templars were, you know, very trendy to talk about, a lot of stories about them, but they got very rich. By the later years, by around 1300, 1250, 1300, they had 90% of them were lay people. Only 10% were actually knights and warriors, but they were parts of the Templars, But because they didn't answer to any king, only to the Pope, they could go anywhere, they couldn't be stopped. They lived these lives. They all had beards. You had to have a beard to be a Templar. They supposedly were, it's like they were a lot like the knights in Game of Thrones. They had to renounce relations with women. A group of guys together renouncing relations with women. What could go wrong?
Nothing.
Absolutely.
Well, nothing from. I taste like shoe leather. Okay.
Yeah.
But the Templars were out there doing their thing, and because they got very rich, people borrowed from them, including this guy, Philip. Oh, small picture. Philip the Fourth, King of France, also known as Philip. No, are you there? Philip the Fair. Philip the Fair may have described his appearance. It certainly didn't describe his behavior. Because Philip owed them a lot of money, and he was trying to unify his kingdom. So he basically told the Pope, we need to get rid of these guys. And the Pope said, but they work for me. They're good guys. And Philip the Fair said, why don't you guys go down and talk to the Pope? And mm-hmm. a group of people went down and talked to the Pope, and the Pope died about a week later from injuries.
Yeah, they beat up the Pope.
And he went to the next Pope and said, I really like you to
get rid of the Knights Templar.
And this guy was like, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. And also, you really should not have done this. You're in trouble. This Pope died mysteriously 6 months later.
Yeah.
And he went to the next Pope and said, you know, we really need to get rid of the Knights Templar. And also about this excommunication you've put on me and this interdict you've put on the Northern France. And you know what the funniest thing is? This Pope said, you're right. In fact, we're going to move the Holy See to France.
Yes. He's going to move the Holy See to the safest place in Italy he could find, which was France. And this begins the popes in Avignon. So from 309 to 387, the Pope 1377, the popes are going to live in southern France in the largest Gothic castle/palace ever built, because nothing says the Pope is infallible like the largest Gothic palace ever built. It's
amazing. It's huge.
It's still there. It's really quite something to see. But this means with the Pope in France, the bishops become French, and then they start to make new popes, and those popes happen to be French. And so the whole character of the church hierarchy starts changing because everybody's in France, which is not making the Italians very happy. Shall we get into that story?
Keep going.
What? You want me to get into the schism?
Oh, the schism?
Yeah.
Okay, there's the schism. I was gonna go ahead and kill off the Knights Templar, but you can
talk. No, about, okay, go ahead and kill off. Kill off the Knights Templar.
Well, actually, I was just going to show you something here for a second, which is I happen to have from our recent vacation some footage from the Palace of Avignon. So keep filling.
Why am I filling? Oh, okay. So this is making the rest of Europe very suspicious of what's going on in the Catholic Church, because now they're in this magnificent palace. It's absolutely gorgeous. And they're not in really the structure they had lived in before. They are in a very different lifestyle.
This is the Rhone River in southern France. This is basically, oops, I can't get out.
Very nice.
Anyway, just some pretty pictures of we just happened to have been there on a vacation, and this is the city of Avignon. Just, yes, we're showing you our travel photos.
Anyway, so gorgeous, gorgeous castles and this and that.
Anyway, this is really kind of irrelevant, but
it's very irrelevant. That's just the outer wall.
That is beautiful.
So go ahead and kill off the Templars.
Hang on, I'm trying to figure out how to exit it. Folks, we're trying some new technology here. Excuse me. Oh, that's pretty. Okay, hang on here. Okay.
There you go.
Very, we're back.
Back to us.
All right, now we're still... So Philip the Fair owes of the Templars a lot of money and decides that the best way to deal with this is to kill him. This is Jacques de Molay. He was the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar. He was taken to Paris and he was questioned at length.
Mm-hmm.
And he revealed that, in fact, the Knights Templar, as part of their ritual, spit on the cross. They would urinate, that they defaced things, that they didn't believe in Jesus, and that their secret rituals involved kissing and other actions upon the posterior of other knights.
Ah.
It's described that way. So basically, now I'm sure some of them were gay, but still. So he confessed to buggery, heresy.
He turned everyone else in.
And so the Knights Templars, you know, as a lot of people know this story, but they were basically eliminated.
Killed off. Burned at the stake.
Burned at the stake in large numbers. Many of them were allowed to convert. But Jacques de Molay is kind of a fun historical character because of the way he was tortured and then recanted his tortured confession. And... anyway, back and forth, and I don't know where it is, but it was. He had some good quotes on the scaffold that I don't have right now. So,
but right now, heresy, because seeing it not just in terms of a couple people here and a couple people here, but large sections of the society, heresy becomes part of the idea of treason. Not just crimes against the church, but crimes against the state, crimes against society. And
I've got to jump in here, I'm sorry, okay. Because I lost my thought. And there was a point of, with the doing in of the Knights Templar, was this very issue, was that in their founding, the innocent who got them going said, you know, mm-hmm. I am the Pope, I appoint kings.
Right.
And Philip basically said, I am the king, the Pope works for me. And this is part of the huge power structure that led to allegations of heresy and movements of real heresy when they saw how corrupt these guys were. But this power struggle mm-hmm. is critically important. And what always happened is you get a strong pope who knows how to play the game, knows how to do things, and then some doddering old guy who goes along. And then you get a crazy king, and then you get another king who's just, hey, I'm king. This is a good job.
Yeah.
And so this political struggle is central to the concept of heresy and how it grew.
And you've got now the Dominicans running around. And the Dominicans were very good at writing up manuals on how to find heresy, how to dig it up. They're going to be writing these huge volumes on how to question these people, how to re-educate them. But now that heresy moves out of the idea of a single person being wrong, coming to the wrong conclusions, but whole societies, we see the character of how the heretics are being treated change. Because for trials of treason, from everything that these Dominicans are writing up, going back to old Roman law, hundreds of years ago, to find someone who is treasonous, to investigate them, you would bring them in and you would question them. And using torture at this time was okay for the people you are questioning.
But torture was
Hang on. And if it's treason, which of course heresy is tied up with now, you can torture the witnesses and you can torture the accuser of all of these, of this, in order to figure out if the crime was real. And the torture, you know, according to these manuals, you couldn't draw blood. You could clamp fingers. You could beat people. And if they were kids, you had to use a smaller cane to beat them with. You couldn't use a full-size cane. But the idea of torture and getting at the truth, they were very firmly connected in these people's minds. It wasn't the idea that, oh, these people are just going to say anything to stop the pain. That wasn't...
Didn't occur to them.
Didn't occur to them. It really didn't.
Wow. And it's a strange one, because torture was never, ever part of the punishment.
No. No, the torture is not the punishment. The torture is finding out the information. That's kind of what we would find a little creepy.
Yes.
There are some writers, Augustine of Hippo, will say, well, if you have to beat them to get the information, well, then you can, you know, like, say, okay, that's part of their punishment, is that you've already beaten them. So that's part and parcel of their punishment. Mostly the torture is strictly during the Inquisition part. It is not during the punishment part. The Catholic Church could not execute people. They could order them to be found as heretics, give them a chance to recant. If they do not recant, then they are lapsed heretics and they're turned over to the secular authority. It is always the secular authority that kills these people.
Or just punishes. Many or went, punishes. Went to prisons, and the Catholic Church did not maintain prisons. They would sometimes confine people in monasteries.
Right.
But punishment was the role of the secular authority.
Right.
That was critically important, although...
There's a real strict differentiation between the two.
Okay. Now, just a quick check here.
Right.
We are almost 2 hours in.
Correct.
I don't know how we're doing. I don't know how our audience is holding up. I did want to get to the flagellants at least.
Okay. Well, and the Black Death? All right.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
Hang on. Let's find out from our hosts how we're doing and just get some guidance here.
What's your time frame on getting those two things in?
10 minutes, 15 minutes? Wrap it up by 10. Does that work for
That's
you
doable.
And your audience?
Go for it.
Okay.
All right. There were a bunch of people called flagellants. They like to beat off.
Ah, stop. Okay.
There's more to it than that?
More to it than that. 1347.
What could possibly go wrong in 1347?
1347, a Genovese ship comes into its home port, onto a port in Sicily.
Birds.
No.
The plague was spread by birds.
Stop. No. The boat ties up. There are many dead people on it, and they're dead in hideous ways. They have horrible black swellings in their armpits and in their groin. And this is the bubonic plague. The bubonic plague is actually a...
Yersinia pestis.
Yersinia pestis. No, it's not.
It's a parasite
on a flea.
Yes.
In a flea. And that's carried by the rats. And once the rats die, then they feed on humans. The fleas were everywhere, so no one really noticed being bitten by fleas. So no one understood what the vector was. We know it now, but at the time, from 1347 on, the plague just spreads throughout Europe. It sometimes will skip over a town and then come back in. It will have three different ways of expressing itself. It will have the bubonic plague with the horrible swollen buboes, the swollen black lymph nodes. That killed you within 3 days. Some people survived. A handful of people could survive that. There was septicemic plague, which is when it gets into the bloodstream. When somebody touches someone infected with the bubonic plague with an open cut or sore on their hand, or they lance the buboes in order to take the swelling down. So that's another way it spread. That usually killed people within 12 to 24 hours. But the worst part was pneumonic plague, which was carried by coughing. You'd spit on somebody, you'd cough on somebody. And you've got to realize these are people who lived in homes and palaces and every place else that was entirely heated by wood, and everybody cooked on wood. And so consequently, you've got an entire population that coughs constantly because they're always in smoky rooms. So this pneumonic version of it would kill within 6 to 8 hours. The eyewitness reports, or if people who they meet someone in the morning, you know, maybe say hello to them, and by the evening they're dead, just gone. And this will affect about half the population of Europe, and they estimate about one-third of the entire population of Europe died from this plague.
Crazy.
And it's going to
That's crazy.
Be hanging
around. Oh,
it's
around. Unbelievable. Yeah. The devastation, we can't really fathom that. That it goes through a town and everything you know is and everything you know is gone. Everything is just changed, and your priests don't help you.
Yes, the priests are dying as fast as anybody else. The monks are dying as fast as anybody else. So where is God?
This challenges the whole orthodoxy, the whole way of thinking about religion, because God isn't helping. Now, there are isolated stories, and you can still hear them. Well, our town prayed the special prayer and so on, and it passed us by. But, you know, when a third of the population is dead, and, you know,
Let me
ask this question, and you may not know the answer to this, but is there a possibility that something like that, like that specific plague, could come back and come through again?
A dozen people in the United States get the plague.
Well, he's talking about
every year
having an epidemic of that nature.
Yes.
Well, the plague, yes, but it's usually
a matter of time before we have a pandemic again, isn't it?
What's that?
Just a matter of time before we have a pandemic?
Yeah.
There's theories on both sides of this because, of course, people travel, vectors are so fast, you know, and you walk downtown, you're going to see somebody 2 degrees of separation to somebody who's been in every part of the world.
But it doesn't matter because the bubonic plague, the pest, the parasite that carries the bubonic plague is present in the fleas and chipmunks on the west side of the Rocky Mountains.
By the way, it is a different plague. The plague has
morphed. It's morphed into different things.
The concept of, you know, I mean, there's obviously been movies about that.
Right.
Cassandra Crossing was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's what The Walking Dead is kind of about, even though they're creepier than that. But
outbreak.
You know, could it happen again is something that there's a lot of people have talked about. Mm-hmm.
AIDS was seen as this kind of disease.
Well, AIDS had this creepy nature of it, and Kyle, you're probably too young to remember when it first hit, but there was this helplessness. It's like nothing seems to work, and there's theories, and there were people with moral ideas that didn't really work, and there was nothing. It was just, and you know, we lost a couple friends to it.
Yeah, we lost several friends to it. Yeah,
and it was just. Yeah, that feeling of helplessness. But when you're in a theocracy, and medieval Europe was a theocracy.
Right. That everyone decided it was God's punishment against them.
Nah.
And so what grows up is a group of people, mainly lay people, who think that they have the answer. And the answer is?
Flagellants. Ooh. Hey,
stop it.
Piece of flagellants there.
Stop it.
I'm sorry, I'm irreverent. Let's see, though. Anyway, there's a picture from the Nuremberg Chronicle about 1400. The flagellants
were groups of people.
They would gather sometimes with the hunters. They would, you know, there's the Monty Python scene, and it's kind of true. They would walk through your town, and they would beat themselves until they bleed.
Flagellants. I thought you were talking about flatulence.
No, flagellants. I was trying to make a sick joke. The flagellants were flagellant. Flagellum means whip. Sorry. Flatulence. You gotta check.
I got
microphone.
You now.
Yes. Is this thing working?
And this was quite the trend of publicly beating yourself, and people, I think they would do it several times a day. I'm assuming they grew numb. or they would
possibly
enjoy it in some ways.
They would sing, they would have prayers, they would gather people in the marketplace, and they would have this religious fervor about it.
And there are some who do it today who still get into this trance-like state. But of course, they also, it gets to be totally holier than thou. I'm superior to you because of how much I beat myself. And that is where they got into trouble. The first recorded public flagellation was actually in 1259, before the plague really hit.
Okay.
By the 1340s, they were banned by the Pope because they were claiming that flagellation absolves you of sins.
Right.
And the Pope said, that's my job.
That's the church's job. They were taking away the church's job.
And this is something we see with a lot of heretical movements, is you're threatening, and we haven't had time to talk about a little bit like the Anabaptists, like there were people who said, denying transubstantiation, which means that God doesn't inhabit the host, therefore you don't really need a priest, so this is a real power threat. So they were a power threat. They were also becoming a public nuisance.
Right.
They really would. They would come through, they would demand money, and
they were themselves vectors.
Yes, because of course they got open sores.
They've got open sores. They're bleeding all over the place. Bits of flesh and blood are flying everywhere while they're beating each other.
And people would go to watch. Like, oh, cool. Hey, Mom, you see this guy? He's really gross.
So rather than ending this plague, they become the vectors of spreading it.
After every flat earth debate, I also do that. I also beat myself like that.
Yeah, I can see that. Are you a vector for flat earth thought? It's a question.
I wish we could go back and change it to the flatulence part, because if they would just put Taco Bells in these towns and flatulence was the way to get rid of it, then there would be no plague. It would be cured.
Let's wrap this up.
Just a couple more things here, because the flatulence were, because they became self-righteous, because they claimed to know more, they were eventually persecuted. And as people who wanted to prove that they were better by enduring pain were taken out and burned. And on one occasion, they burned over 300 of them in one day.
Right.
Oh, hands. But this,
and they didn't play back then.
Pain? We'll show you pain.
Yeah. We'll be happy back to then.
So you want to start wrapping it up, talk about some full circle about what have we learned?
What have we learned? What are we taking away from this that we're insane?
Yes, these are two
people were mean back then. People were very mean back then.
But.
And they still are.
We have not gotten to all of the heretics. There will be bigger and more impressive heretical movements like Wycliffe and the Lollards, and that's going to lead into the Peasants' Revolt in England, and of course Jan Hus and the Hussites, and that's going to be a huge war. That's something we'll have to talk about later. That's something that we've actually made a documentary on.
Yeah.
That
we can pitch that in Giordano we can Bruno pitch and Giordano, get on up until even like the Millerites. Joan of Arc. We had a whole bunch on Joan of Arc, but that's okay. Yeah. You know who Joan of Arc was. She's this.
I would love to do a show on Joan of Arc. Voices.
Yep. But then all of a sudden things change. Martin Luther. That's the dividing line.
Well, Martin Luther changed because his group became mainstream and survived.
Right.
And as I said, the Waldensians are still around, but they kind of merged. There's a few others of these.
There's Hussites still around.
Hussites were reestablished.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite count. There's a few others that survived in smaller numbers. The Manichaeans lasted until the 15th century in China. But with Luther, you had what was a heresy become mainstream enough that suddenly...
Well, but he had weapons on his side. He had weapons on his side. Number one, he was preaching a message against indulgences, which were things that you could purchase in order to get your family out of purgatory. He had a message against those and against a whole bunch of other things that was very popular to people. Number two, he could get the message out. The printing press had been developed just before Martin Luther had started preaching. So that's another difference. Instead of one guy in one place giving a message out.
For the record, we disagree on this.
Yeah.
I believe the reason that Martin Luther survived and succeeded and changed the whole dynamic of how we look at heresy is that his principal opponent was Charles V of Spain, who was the Holy Roman Emperor, who basically allowed the Lutherans, he could have gone to war with them. And he allowed them to survive because he was too busy making money off the Americas.
Right.
And Charles was basically at the time when Spain had just taken over South America.
Right.
And that was where his mind was. And I think, honestly, yes, the Columbus helped change the attitude towards heresy.
Right. Because Columbus, what Columbus and Vespucci and Magellan showed everybody in Europe was that all of a sudden there was a hemisphere out there that the Bible did not talk about. They had, before Columbus, they had completely figured out where everyone was from. You know, you had the separate sons of Abraham, Ishmael, and Isaac, the sons of Ham, and they could trace where everybody in Asia and the Middle East and Africa and Europe was from. But here's a continent, two continents that were not mentioned in the Bible, that they had no way of fitting into their genealogy.
Okay. But we also, the printing press and
that
information,
that really blew literacy. Their minds. So,
and the downfall of feudalism, there's a whole bunch of stuff that happened.
And Luther had very strong, prominent, and rich supporters. The princes of Germany saw that if they could separate themselves from the Catholic Church, then their tithes were no longer going to the Catholic Church, and they didn't have.
Anyway, this is a bigger topic, and we don't have time to go into it. But one of the things that I take away from this whole discussion is the stupid you will always have with you. I think that's in the Bible, isn't it? Something like that.
Something like that.
But it's how you deal with them. And, you know, I think you guys do a great job in exposing some of the dumber ideas in our society. And I really think it's good that you don't kill them.
Well, but
there are so many occasions where I would love to have the option to put them on a rack or flay them alive.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was not an option. Yeah, that news to me.
We are happy having... We love dissent. We love the underdog. We love that somebody goes up against. We're rooting for the David against the Goliaths. But I think that kind of idea comes from post-printing press, post-scientific method, post-Age of Enlightenment. And we have moved the world around to understand things better. And we feel that we have an agency in how we think, that we no longer have to be dependent on other people telling us, that authority telling us what to think.
The scientific revolution is a huge part of it.
Well, and that takes
textual. There's a way that we know what we know.
Right.
As opposed to, it's in a book and this man in a funny hat says it's true. We know, and this is one of the reasons why I think science education is so important, is, you know, don't tell me that heat rises. Tell me how you know that heat rises.
Right.
Tell me how you know how fast the speed of light travels, because that's science, that's an understanding, and that's something we can work with.
And the scientific method is a human-based standard. We don't have an authority giving us this information. We can test it ourselves. We can understand it that way. We do not need received wisdom.
And we have to continue to fight for that, because right. there are certainly people who say, well, my professor says, as if that explains something.
Yep. Yeah.
And
yeah.
my professor don't. Says things about history.
Don't listen to me.
You're both fantastic ministers of scientism, by the way.
So you finish with your final.
How much do the Illuminati pay you to? Divulge.
Yeah, you're both. Well, that was, I must tell you guys, I've got to tell you both, that was fantastic. People didn't want you to, people didn't want you to end it there. So I have to tell you that, I believe we have a couple super chats. And then guys, if you have any questions, just make sure you tag me in them and then I'll ask them. But Steve, you want to, I have a question real quick. Is that an Oscar on your mantle behind you?
No.
Nope.
That is, that is a Telly Award. It's actually a fairly low-level award. We have better awards on the walls upstairs, but it is they decided to make it look like that. It's done for a group of TV commercials we did a million years ago. But cool.
That was a question out of the live chat. So.
Sorry?
That was a question that happened in the live chat, so I wanted to settle the debate.
Okay, yeah, it does look like it in the video. That's true. That's also a Native American pottery or basket. And there's a replica of a 18th-century potting telescope.
Be more gentle with it.
That's something that. What's the backstory on this?
This is a Wintu basket. The Wintus were a tribe in Northern California. This was given to my grandmother almost 100 years ago by Mr. Barker. And it's these kind of baskets are woven so tightly that you can boil water in them.
But she won't
they cooked
me.
In them. No, I won't let him do that. But
That's
they're
insane.
Really meaningful.
That is pretty impressive.
Here's something for you. The Wintus would make baskets and would try to make them as good as they possibly could. And when a Wintu died, their baskets were buried with them. And I always challenge my students, why? If you were a nomadic people, Stone Age people, like the Wintu were, just barely in the kind of the Neolithic period, but they did not build shelters that much. They used obsidian tools, and they wove these amazing baskets. Why, if these were the most important things you had, they did everything with these baskets, why would you bury them?
Because you need them in the afterlife.
With the dead. Pardon?
You need them in the afterlife.
Nope. It that might
too
have
much
been
to carry?
Some religion, but there was a very practical reason why they buried them.
Keep the basket.
Too much to carry.
Nope.
Go on.
Nope. The basket went with the basket maker to make sure that every generation learned how to make the baskets perfectly.
Okay. Job security.
Just making sure that everyone knew how to make the basket as well as they
possibly could. Throw them in the deep end philosophy.
Yeah, they wouldn't have to remake, you know, you wouldn't have to learn it again. And they would
that
be
is
guaranteed
awesome.
passing the baskets down.
I can't believe you can boil water out of that. Steve, you want to go ahead and read Super
go
Chats?
Ahead, yeah.
All right. Andrew Batella, £5. Aristotle, quote, "The earth is flat. Gravity is fake. Things fall to the ground because earth attracts earth. Fire attracts fire." Yeah. By the way, Aristotle got a lot of stuff wrong, but he was great for his time.
Aristotle never said the earth was flat. No, Aristotle said
I
the
know.
Earth was round. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. He was kidding. But he did get a lot of stuff wrong, like the square of opposition and stuff. But yeah, that was a fake quote. He wasn't being serious.
Yes.
KW New York Upstate, $2. Didn't they find the Holy Grail in the Last Crusade? I believe they did, didn't they? Was that the movie though, not the actual.
I stopped watching those the Indiana
Last
Jones.
Crusade's got Sean Connery in him.
Yeah, I know.
For Sean
I do still do. Still
yeah,
do.
But who doesn't? Did they find the Last Crusade? Yes. Obviously, the Holy Grail. The mythos of the Holy Grail is curious about how he was believed to have been taken to England and
with Joseph of Arimathea.
I don't know where the story came from, but obviously, you know, there's nothing. Yeah. So.
And the last one, and probably kind of a good way to end this. So if you got nothing else, Kyle, maybe they can kind of end it with this. Ikinu 5 for $5 says, please have them do the Spanish Inquisition sketch again. That is all.
We'll have to practice.
I mean, yeah.
They want you to put your that scene where you put your hats on very dramatically.
Yeah, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Stop. But don't do this right. Oh, look, here's a picture of who is that? That's Jacques de Molay. Let me find my Inquisition picture here.
That's good. Now you're supposed to say no one expects. That's yeah.
Anyway, so de Molay was, of course, not really part of the Inquisition. Do I have any images of the Inquisition here? The Dominicans were very much the guys behind the Inquisition.
Right. In the Monty Python sketch, the red robes, they wouldn't have worn the red robes. That was because that would mean that they're cardinals, Cardinal Fang.
Oh, you're killing my childhood memories.
Yeah.
My childhood is a lie now.
There was, of course, Inquisition was started, as we said, in France, but it spread, and there was, you know, an Inquisition in France and Germany. And,
you're not on us.
And
that does look like Steve in the picture.
Yeah,
it looks like Steve in the picture.
Yeah. A little.
And then, of course, there was the Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise and fear. Our two main weapons are fear and surprise. Yeah. Fanatical devotion to the Pope. Our three main
amongst our many weapons.
Bravo.
Fear, surprise. Hold on, I'll go out and do it again.
Yes. Anyway, yes, I made Jerry a Samara.
Sorry.
I made Jerry a heritage hat.
That was fantastic.
Kind of the dunce's cap.
And of course, you know, there's a this is from a painting that you know, the guy's really putting a hat on her. Let's see if I can find the original.
Yeah, that's okay. You got rid of it. You said you didn't need it.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Come back to the video, please.
Come back to Earth.
Yeah.
But anyway, what else have I got to say? Again, I wasn't really expecting that.
No. We weren't expecting the Spanish Inquisition.
You look like a very fancy chef, too. Okay. You could pass for a very fancy chef as well.
Yes, indeed. And what do they roast in this hat?
Yeah. You don't want to know what they roast in that hat.
I can't wait for you guys to do the dead parrot routine. If you guys can do the dead parrot routine, I will do it. Go ahead.
I don't know. He wants us to do the dead parrot.
You don't know the dead parrot routine?
I don't know it well enough. I would ruin it. I can't.
How could you not know the dead parrot? Yeah, that was the greatest skit of all time, I think. He is no more.
Yes.
It's an ex-parrot. He's pining for the fjords. Yeah, Michael Payne.
The Norwegian blue prefers kipping on its back.
It's funny.
This was fantastic.
Hello, Polly!
We could talk about what the hat means in the degradation ritual, but I think we're past the serious part of this show.
We're past the serious part of the show. I think
we're past the serious part.
We're way past it.
You guys deserve a standing ovation. So the entire live chat and all of us applaud you, and that was just fantastic. You have to come back and do something together. I mean, you two should do your own channel with this stuff every day. Like, you can make these history history things just interesting.
We actually have set up a channel. We haven't done anything with it yet, but if people want to go and check it out,
well, no, don't go yet because we don't have it.
Well, there's nothing on it. We have this channel, we just don't have anything on it. We're talking about starting something maybe once every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Called History Unsettled.
History Unsettled. And we're looking to kind of take a topic every week and take a time period and just basically chat about it, go into depth.
And one of the ideas is to look at stuff in history that isn't agreed upon. And
right.
I don't mean like who really invented the airplane, but was World War I inevitable?
Right.
You know, that's a deep question that we could really, you know, there are arguments on both sides, and the subtext is that
right.
Historians don't always know.
No, and part of the idea of the show is to go into some of the historical methods, talk about why historians don't agree on these things, what sort of evidences are they looking at, how they actually argue about it, who's been writing about it, how the understanding of these periods changes over time.
Mm. Yes. The name is fantastic, by the way.
Oh, okay.
The name is fantastic.
And it's just the problem is that we both have jobs.
Yeah.
Jobs.
Yeah. But still, I mean, you know, even if you did some a couple of weeks, the name and your logo, I think, is the most important things that you do as a channel. I think if you have those two things down right, then the rest of it kind of feels in itself. But if you're going to be your brand, and History Unsettled is just catchy.
One of the things you guys do very well is you're on every night. so people know that, and so you can build a fan base. And, you know, like with my own channel, I haven't done anything on it in 3 years.
No.
Because it's a lot of work.
Oh, but, you've got a new one up.
Well, yeah. Useless History Channel, yes, which is just silly stories. There's so much I want to do in life, and my boss doesn't understand. Oh, hey, you've got a new subscriber.
Yeah, you know what? I know who it was, too. It was Landon Kurt Noel was your new subscriber.
Yay. All right. Excellent.
World famous astronomer, computer scientist, mathematician, Landon Kurt Noel was your subscriber.
Well, we're gonna wrap up and say goodnight to everyone. But this was amazing as always. Do you have anything that you want to? Yes, and we know you'll be back. Well, stay tuned on Sunday too, because you might be walking out with a golden nun. Not that that means anything in the grand scheme of things, but
I think we're going to have to be handing out $20 bills. I think that's what's going to work.
Well, who are the judges?
No, it's the
people vote. Oh, the people. Yeah. The people vote.
Like I said, I'm going to have to start handing out bills.
It's been about there were several votes cast in your neck and neck with.
Yeah, Jerry's not on Twitter. I am. If people want to follow me, because I follow a lot of different historians. I can be found on Twitter on 3M Griffith, 3 and then capital M and then Griffith. So people are welcome to follow me if they would like. And I'm always retweeting all sorts of interesting historians and what they're doing.
And if you... If you guys give me the link to your channel, we'll put it in the description. That way people can start heading over there and subscribing. And they can click that bell. They can – what did they say, Steve? Smash that bell.
That's the like button.
Smash that like. Don't – you can't smash the like button, okay? Please stop saying that. No. But if you push the bell notification icon, and that way when you upload your first video, they can be notified about it.
Yeah, well, actually, ring the bell, and it may eventually work for you if YouTube decides they'll make it work for you, because it's hit or miss sometimes.
Yeah, but smash that like button, y'all.
Tell my boss.
Shut up and subscribe.
We're YouTubing. Closed for YouTubing.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll look at your comments afterwards and find out if we droned on too long.
They're going to love you.
Because we gave them violence. We didn't give them enough sex.
Not enough sex. Next time,
there was
sex
in some of these movements, by the way.
Yeah, never enough sex.
We didn't talk about the Adamites. Fox,
you're going to have to invite
That's
us
okay,
back
because.
Talk about the Adamites.
These are the get cheated. Naked, to have sex in the woods people.
I feel cheated. So in order to combat.
This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter, at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon Saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.